police officer, Aaron.
Yes, sorry, police officer.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
I'm a slasher, and I must be stopped.
You're a what?
A slasher of prices. Just kidding. I'm Simon Skinner. I run the local supermarché. Drop in and see me sometime. My discounts are criminal.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Wreckatopia, episode 103. I am joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Cinerinos.
And Jeremy Scott.
Bam, bam.
I am Chris Atkinson. Today is today's big recommend is Hot Fuzz. And welcome, chat. Thank you once again for coming out to watch us on a Tuesday. Does anybody want to start us off with some small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I am recently realizing my power as a beverage influencer.
Mm-hmm.
I know of at least one person who, after I raved about the Liquid Death teas on a previous episode, went out and bought a couple cases of it. Yes, he is one of our co-hosts, Aaron Dicer, but I am certain listeners did the same. Today, I bring you a beverage I only discovered just yesterday. Just yesterday, I was in the grocery with my wife, and I saw what out of the corner of my eye looked like the Canada Dry Cranberry, which is a fantastic soft drink. They make it available year round now instead of just at Christmas. They also have a blackberry ginger ale. It's also very excellent, but it wasn't the cranberry one. I looked closer and it said Fruit Splash Cherry. There it is. Fruit Splash. They even make a zero sugar version. It's Fruit Splash Cherry Ginger Ale. I bought the sugared version because I didn't see a zero sugar. I took one sip and almost ran over to my wife, who loves the cranberry one, and handed it to her. And she was like, oh, we got to get the zero sugar of this. Probably one of my favorite new soft drink flavors that I've tried in ages.
Mm.
And I have seen it now in the last 2 days at Publix and at Kroger here in Tennessee. Probably in your local gas station. They had a big display in Kroger this morning. So I think they're pushing it pretty hard. And I cannot recommend this enough if you have liked any of their fruit-tinged ginger ales in the past. There you go. Canada Dry, Fruit Splash, Cherry.
I cannot promise that I won't immediately buy a case of this, too. I am firmly a Jeremy drink beverage follower aficionado. No, I had to get me some peach tea.
Has it arrived yet?
Yeah, I think the cases have eight in them. And they're like just under $2 a pop is like the cheapest I could find them for. So, I got one of the Armless Palmer and one of the Rest in Peach cases enjoyed both very, very much. I think I like the peach a little bit better. That's the one
My wife does too. I think I like the lemon one a little better. But I did try the just straight agave tea that didn't have any fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a little too sweet for me. It was basically like sweet tea, even though it's still only just a little bit of agave in there. But
I, however, am not going to talk about beverages, but I am going to talk about pop. I'm going to talk about The Greatest Night in Pop, which is on
Netflix. I thought you meant like pot.
No, not that. This is a documentary about the night that they recorded We Are the World. And I will say, the amount of secondary footage and sound clips and things in this movie make it worth the price of your Netflix subscription for the month alone. Like, it is really, really fascinating to be in this room with all of these mega superstars trying to leave their ego at the door and trying to record this thing together. Like, it is, if you've ever been in any kind of group recording experience, you know how interesting it can get. Like, how you know, things can happen during the takes and how sometimes there's just that one person who just can't get it. And everybody has to kind of be patient with them. And that was Bob Dylan. And
perfect.
So like, but that's the thing. It's like, it's Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, Cyndi Lauper, Bruce Springsteen, and Ray Charles. Like, you can just keep going on. And as interesting it is as it is to watch these superstars record this song, it is just as interesting, at least for me, to hear some of the backstory behind the writing of it, how it happened, how Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson were supposed to write it with Stevie Wonder, but Stevie Wonder would never call them back, so they just went ahead and wrote it, the two of them. And Stevie Wonder, I'm giving away one of the stories, Stevie Wonder pops in the day before the actual recording, goes, okay, let's write this song. And they're like, dude, we already wrote it. So Lionel Richie is a revelation in this. I have a lot of respect for that guy, and he is a super talented musician. And I think that really comes through here. And he's so very personable and interesting. I didn't realize he hosted the American Music Awards the same day they recorded this.
Oh,
so
wow.
And that's part of the story, is how it coincides with the American Music Awards. And they just, after the awards, went over there and did this thing till like 7 the next morning. And it's just, it's wild to watch this. So I think this is a really good watch.
You prompted me to Google, because... this is who I am. I immediately thought, who's the lamest person that was part of this? Who's
Dan Aykroyd? Least?
Well, okay, you just killed my joke. But I was going to go with Cyndi Lauper in terms of like the soloists, because you run down the list of soloists that I'm seeing here.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, almost everyone is like a all-time Hall of Fame icon. And Cyndi Lauper was just popular at the time.
Right.
But then you look over to the chorus, what the fuck is Dan Aykroyd doing here?
Somebody pushed for Bette Midler and Dan Aykroyd to be there, and that's why they were there.
Who did?
Somebody wanted them there.
Oh, and Sheila E.
Well, I feel that's like... a really interesting story. The Sheila E. thing is really interesting, and she is the other thing I liked about this, and I'm glad you prompted me on this, is that it's not afraid to get into kind of the nitty-gritty a little bit. The Sheila E. thing, she's glad that she was a part of it. Obviously, she feels like she was a part of history. But she was a manipulative part of what they were doing to try to get Prince there. And so it's really interesting for her to hear her talk about that and how she felt used kind of thing.
I don't see Prince's name in this
Prince
list.
Prince didn't go. But the part of the story is they kept her around as long as possible, even though she didn't have a solo.
Just trying to
get Prince to come do the solo. It's lots of interesting stuff like that in this documentary. So I'd highly recommend it. Yeah.
Hmm. That song was everywhere came out. It played everywhere you turned. It was crazy. It's amazing they got all those egos all in one one place to do that.
You can also take this song and Michael Jackson's Heal the World and accidentally sing them merged together without realizing it. I did that the other day.
So I watched a movie last week. I'm not a big romantic comedy person. I generally hate romantic comedies. Not because I'm against love or anything like that. But it's just, they're all the same movie to me. They're all the exact same. They always just like, let's just go ahead and get whoever's hot in the lead male role, and let's get whoever's hot in the lead female role, and then let's have them hate each other at the beginning, and then something happens somewhere where it's like, they'll start dating again, start dating and everything. But there's one that came out in 2008 that I thought was really good, and I saw it again last week. Definitely Maybe, starring Ryan Reynolds, in which he is a man who is about to divorce his wife. We don't know who his wife is yet, and he is taking his daughter home from school, daughter played by Abigail Breslin, who is absolutely fantastic in this movie. She wants to hear the story of how he met mom. This movie came out during the time of How I Met Your Mother and everything like that. But this is kind of a different sort of a different take on it. And basically this is Ryan Reynolds going back all the way to 1992, where he is, working for the Bill Clinton campaign, and it gets all the way to the present. And there are three potential women that this could be. It's either going to be Elizabeth Banks, it's going to be Isla Fisher, or it's going to be Rachel Weisz. By the end of it, you're going to find out who the mother is. And he changes the names of all the women so that she doesn't, so that Abigail Breslin can't guess it right off the bat. He tells these stories with different names and so on. And like, it's one of these movies where like every time you think one of the women has been marked off, they come back somehow later on in the movie, and you're like, oh, well, maybe she's the mom or whatever. And then that's not even the point of the movie, really, to find out who the mom is. It's really to figure out who he ends up with by the end of it. So I thought this was really good. I think Isla Fisher is just one of my like favorite all time. She's just so adorable. I just love her in this movie, love her to pieces in this movie. Of course I love Elizabeth Banks and Rachel Weisz too, but she's a standout in this. And this is a different thing for Ryan Reynolds too, because Ryan Reynolds, I mean, he's done a lot of these type of movies. He's done different from Van Wilder and Deadpool, but that's what we kind of know him as, is that character and everything. And he's really, really good in this. And I highly recommend this. This is a different kind of romantic comedy, so there you go. Let's go with that.
We must have been on some kind of wavelength, because I was flipping channels sometime last week and this was on, and I watched about 40 minutes of this and hadn't seen it in a while, and you're right, it's quite enjoyable.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah, all right, so go on to our big recommend, which is Hot Fuzz. And Aaron,
I'm fine, it's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Hot Fuzz, Edgar Wright's second in the Cornetto trilogy, and I believe over time has become many people's favorite of the three. Comedy from Edgar Wright. We begin the movie with sirens. Lots and lots of sirens in a vaguely Simon Pegg-shaped figure walking with purpose towards us before narrow positioning us with his various accomplishments. We quickly get the idea that this man, our protagonist, is the classic overachiever, so much so that Bilbo, Davy Jones, and Alan Partridge have to team up to ship him off to be a sergeant in a quaint country town because he's making all of the police in London look bad. Mm-hmm. So Nicholas Angel, as we come to know him, goes to a crime scene there in town to tell his ex Janine that he's being transferred. And then we are a few comedic smash cuts away from checking into his hotel in a town called Sanford by a woman who is either doing a crossword or actually thinks fascism is lovely, or maybe both. Angel then goes to a local pub to kick out some underage drinkers and almost get drunk driven over by a guy named Danny Butterman. This is played by Nick Frost. He arrests Danny and then finds out the next day he is, dun, 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 a fellow policeman and the son of his boss.
Police officer, Aaron.
Yes, sorry, police officer. Angel is shown around the station where he finds out the evidence room is empty. People throw trash bins at their coworkers, and Oscar winner Olivia Colman gets around. After a quick pub break with the crew, where we discover Danny is a big action movie fan, this, of course, will play into the movie quite a bit, and is also very interested in various ways of firing bullets, we find ourselves at the neighborhood watch meeting where we learn of the scourge of the living statue, which will pay off at some point. Some more hilarious quick cut montaging as Sergeant Angle gets settled in with various tasks and Constable Butterman enjoys his favorite Cornetto. They then visit James Bond's grocery store, which leads to a shoplifter foot chase through people's gardens. That's British for yards, in case you didn't know. But Mr. Skinner decides not to press charges, but instead brings everybody at the station some biscuits. That's British for cookies, in case you didn't know. We also get a Shakespearean lesson on the value of the police notepad and an inquiry about the joys of firing a gun into the air while saying, ah. And then the murders begin. The Shakespearean couple are decaffeinated, and it's staged to be a car accident, or shall we say, not an accident. What do they say? A collision. A collision. A car collision. Mm. But Angel is suspicious after visiting a farmer in need of double translators, as well as a bigger weapon shed. We get a nice sit-down conversation where Angel explains to Butterman why he was destined to be a police officer. And Butterman explains that his story is about staying close to his dad after his mom died, before punctuating that emotion by doing the very first magic trick I ever learned straight out of a Penn & Teller book that I got when the Scholastic Book Fair was in town. True story. After they get a little bit drunk, because he's little and he's drunk, they hang out at Danny's, where they watch Point Break, chat about Nick's forbidden horticultural desires, and fall asleep while watching Bad Boys. All while another staged murder over a classic British fry-up, that's British for we like baked beans with our breakfast foods for some reason, brings us further into this strange case. The next day, Angel is suspicious again, but the Andes are sure it's just an accident before doing my favorite GIF in the history of, yes, I'm pronouncing it correctly, GIFs. It's the one where they both walk off screen and then the first Andy comes back into frame and then slides out again. It's my favorite moment in the movie. It just slays me. Later at the Great British Church Bake, something is amiss as we see a hooded figure push a steeple off the roof. And in a death that even the Final Destination movies would be jealous of, a man brings new meaning to the phrase religious headcase. This eventually leads to Danny and Nicholas hitting the third act conflict cliche about 30 minutes ahead of schedule, and some ponderous music as Angel tries to put together the pieces of this mystery.
How much time do you spend on this write-up?
I just write it as I'm watching.
Doesn't feel like that's what you do.
I don't even pause, man. I don't even pause.
That's crazy. Okay, go on.
So I do go back and judge a little bit. I should say that. I do go back and judge a little bit. But yeah. The next day at work, they make up after finding out it's actually Danny's birthday. Angel sneaks by Oscar winner Olivia Colman's simulated breasts to go get his buddy a Japanese water lily, but instead witnesses a fourth murder, but then can't catch the hooded killer. But he's pretty sure it's Skinner, so the whole police force goes down to arrest him, only to have him absolved by the security footage and the lack of a leg wound. Then, after a severe case of brainwave while eating his favorite Cornetto, he realizes he needs to see more Scream movies because it's multiple murderers! He figures it out. Later that night, Angel is attacked by the town's monosyllabic mammoth, but manages to escape and discover that the murders are the result of a dun-dun-dun cult, or maybe an HOA. I don't know. Same difference.
Yeah, it kind of is.
And, oh no, the police chief is also involved, and no, dear God, no, not Danny, too. Danny shows up and seems to go along with it as well. He tries to then escape through the crypts, where he sees the murder and depravity goes further than he could have ever imagined. But he's eventually stopped and stabbed by the only man in town he thought he could trust, one of the dwarves from Snow White and the Huntsman. But it was a ruse. The old catch-up trick works, and Angel is convinced to flee until he sees some action DVDs and decides to take the town back in one final action set piece that is somehow both hilarious and awesome for about 20 minutes straight, leading to payoffs on about a dozen different things, including a swan, a miniature town, and Aaron Aronson. After one of the most ridiculous epilogues ever, we finally see that the town is back in good hands, and now when anyone asks Angel if he's seen someone fire a gun into the air and say, ah, he can respond by simply saying, yarp. That is Hot Fuzz. What did you guys think this time through?
I love this movie.
It's so good!
It is definitely my favorite of the Cornetto trilogy. What I enjoy the most about this movie is almost nothing is wasted. What I like is at the beginning when he goes into the hotel or whatever, She's doing that crossword, and you know, she calls him a fascist, and then he's like, the word's actually fascism, and then he goes hag, and then he tells her that's 12 down, go ahead and do hag, and I was, oh, thank you very much, blah 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 blah. And then of course later on in the shootout, she calls him a fascist again, and then he calls her a hag, and I just love that type of stuff. They just keep doing that. They keep doing that all the way throughout. This is a movie filled with all sorts of like British legendary actors and everything. One of them is Edward Woodward, who was in The Wicker Man, who was the main guy in The Wicker Man, which this movie patterns itself off a little bit. There's Billy Whitelaw, who's in The Omen, who's like basically the secondary villain in that movie. Of The Omen, of course, they had like an Omen homage in this thing. There's even a quick cutaway to a swear jar talking about the fix the church roof, which then comes into play later on in the movie. There's constant stuff in the background that ends up going in play when he first walks into the little hotel. There's swords that the guy sleeping ends up using in the battle at the end. There's the whole introduction of all the characters when he's going through the town that ends up being the exact place where the shootout happens. They're all in the exact places. I love this relationship between Simon Pegg and Nick Frost in this. This is so good. This is like a romantic relationship that's never really like it never goes to like, you know, them going to bed or anything, but it's everything except that, just about.
Yeah, they even cuddle while watching movies. Like, it's,
there's,
you know,
a point where Simon Pegg says, oh, I wish I could just take my brain out and not think about any of this type of stuff, and he's like, I have a way of doing that, and he looks longingly in his eyes, and then he gets up and he goes straight to his DVD collection and pulls out which one, Point Blank or Bad Boys 2. and so it's just a nice little comment on the fact that you can take your brain out and watch Point Blank and Bad Boys 2 and just have fun and not worry about it and everything. But there's parts where he, you know, he's won that monkey for him. He's won the monkey for him. He's not won the monkey for himself. He gave it to him. And later on, he's trying to buy him a Japanese peace lily, which is another thing that's so funny about that. And then I love the fact that the peace lily ends up being something that is used for violence. That is just stuff that they just constantly throw in these movies. And you can't just, I mean, you could watch this movie 10 times probably and not catch everything.
Absolutely. I pick up something new every single time. Every single time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, I'm a big, huge fan of this movie. I think when I first watched it in theaters, I wasn't prepared for it. And I was a little upset about how long it felt to me when I watched it. But ever since the second viewing on, I've just been on board with this as one of my favorite movies of all time.
We were talking before the show about Edgar Wright and how he's got this massive list he keeps online of the best movies ever, and we've only ever seen like 30% of them. That is represented fully in this movie. His wealth of knowledge and detail. I think what I like about the movie is that you can enjoy it on two different levels. I think it is a perfectly enjoyable movie, even if you don't catch any of the references to other movies at all. Even if you don't know those three men sending him to the country in the beginning of the movie are three of the most important actors of our time from England. Even if you just think they're extras, I think you can enjoy this movie on that level. But I think the more films you watch, the greater your knowledge of film in general, the more you can appreciate it. And I say that knowing that I won't be able to fully appreciate Hot Fuzz for probably another 30 years. That's how many movies I need to watch. Like you guys were saying, there's so much to catch. But I made a note very similar to yours, Chris, about how there's nothing wasted here. Everything is here for a reason, and everything is intentional. And the section I wrote down isn't the same parts that you mentioned, but like the section where the killer is thumping the victim on the head, but then it cuts to Simon Pegg flopping down into the chair. And then not too long after that, you get, you're pulling my leg, and it cuts directly to the killer dragging a victim by pulling their leg. Like every bit of this film is there on purpose. And I appreciate that kind of filmmaking more and more the older I get. It's just...
Well, and not to mention too, the where he's like, it's about to pop off or something like that. And he hits the remote and that's when the bomb explodes and everything, which is, you know, every I think every character who dies in this movie has something that they say where they're about to die, or they sort of, I'm about to pop off, or I'm about to do this. I'm about, and they die right after they say that. So it's really awesome.
I noticed on IMDb trivia that the Danny character was originally a love interest, a female. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when they made it a male, they just didn't change most of the dialogue. And I think that's part of why it has that rom-com feeling. I certainly think that was intentional, that this movie wants to have some of that in there, but I think it's hilarious to try and go back and think of certain scenes and picture a woman saying them, and then picture how Nick Frost is, because Nick Frost's delivery is most of the fun for me. It's not just what he says, but like there's a line near the end where Simon Pegg says he's appointed himself judge, jury, and executioner, and without any self-knowledge at all, he goes, he's not Judge Judy and executioner, and the movie just moves on. It's like, that is a joke for you if you hear it, if you have the captions on, like, so me, it probably plays a little better. But even if you think he's merely repeating Simon Pegg, it's hilarious because of the way Nick Frost says it. I love all the little bits of humor that made me think of nods to, like, there's a bit where he walks in to tell his girlfriend or his ex that he's leaving, and he walks up, he says, Janine, I've been transferred, I'm moving away for a while, and a male voice behind the mask goes, I'm not Janine. That felt like an airplane movie kind of gag. There's a moment where Danny tries to jump the fences like Nick had just done, and instead trips, falls into the fence, and it breaks, and that's like vaudeville type stuff. The movie has every kind of comedy, from like witty wordplay to physical comedy to parody. It's almost too much, if that makes sense. I'm praising it, but it's like one of those meals that's just, by the end, you're like, that was too much rich food. Like, I need more time to process. It's my favorite of his trilogy. I think it showcases his editing techniques.
Editing well is ridiculous.
Any of the movies this time through made me wish hard for that Ant-Man movie we're never going to get, because what he could have done with his editing style.
Well, that's what I was thinking too. There's the very sharp thing at the beginning where he's going from London to Sanford, where it's going on the trains and the taxis and everything. Yeah. And it's every movie we watch, it seems like, does this whole thing where it's like, well, it's time to kind of sit back and just do nothing for a second. We'll see a train passively moving along on the tracks. We'll see him get into a taxi. This is the time for the opening credits. We'll just throw the opening credits over all of this and everything. And here he's just like, you know, and he's admittedly, you know, stealing from Martin Scorsese, and he's stealing from, you know, Darren Aronofsky and people like that who do this kind of thing. He's also stealing a lot. He loves in the commentary, he loves citing Tony Scott in this, especially movies like Man on Fire and Domino, things like that is what he kept citing in that. But there's another, this is just a random thing. This podcast could just be about all the moments in this thing, but, the another one that I love is when he goes to the person who sells the flowers, and she tells that whole story about, like, you know, this is basically what in a normal murder mystery movie would be the reasons why these people are getting killed. They are getting killed for far, far more mundane reasons than what could actually be a real like motive for murder that she sets out. But every time she brings up a victim in the story, she's a God rest her soul, God rest the soul, God rest all other souls. Like every time she's already mentioned a couple of these people and just keeps on saying God rest their soul. I love stuff like that too. It's And I love the chase afterwards where he's running and then suddenly like they're like 20 feet ahead of them. They can't possibly have gotten that far that fast. And you can just see the look on Simon Pegg's face like, huh, what just happened? You know, but yeah, anyway.
You guys have mentioned a lot of the stuff that I would pull out, especially the love story. I have in my notes, I have that the Angel Butterman love story is genuinely touching to me. Like not just that it's, you know, interesting or funny, or like I genuinely am moved by their relationship in this movie, which is, I think, one of Edgar Wright's magic tricks is that he makes these comedies that somehow work as actual movies and not just parodies, right? Like you watch Shaun of the Dead and it's kind of a parody of, you know, zombie movies, and yet is a really great zombie movie that just works as a movie. And I think Hot Fuzz does the same as, you know, a police action movie where it's clearly an elevated reality kind of parody at times, but it all feels so authentic. It feels so genuine somehow. And I think a lot of that has to do with that central relationship and how authentic it feels. And I think Peg and Frost chemistry is just next level. And I think it just adds to the movie so much. You also mentioned that you catch something new every time. It's definitely true. A couple things I caught this time that I'll just mention. And again, these are things that people, like, the thing about this is, the things I'm about to say, some people are going to catch the first time. Some people are going to catch the second time. Some people are going to catch the third time. It's just the movie presents itself in different ways because it's so dense. You know, it's so tightly woven. The fact that the Skinner character's game is Splat the Rat, which is, again, in a callback shown. I just didn't put together the rat part of that until this time. Like, you know, the idea of the splat made sense to me, but then, the rat is somebody who's telling stories that they shouldn't be telling, or, you know, whatever. And he's literally playing a game called Splat the Rat, was something I picked up on this time. A comedic moment I picked up on this time, the mugshots at the end. He still has the steeple coming through his mouth in his mugshot. It's so quick. Like, it happens so fast. But instead of taking it out, they just bandaged his chin with the steeple still coming through the bottom of his face for his mugshot. Just absolutely slayed me this time.
Not to mention that he's writing all the vitals on that one kid with the cone on his head, and like, and then he has to go back and write the correct height on the thing and everything. I love that too. And also there's that scene where he goes through that house where all the dead people are, that, you know, that they, the dead people we didn't even know about. And like his memories are in the exact order of the things that he sees in the thing. So he's like, you know, it's like that's like it's the kids, it's the drunk kids, it's the jugglers, and then, like, of course it's the living statue, the abomination and everything. I also love the fact that they're doing that Village of the Year thing. You don't even know they're doing that Village of the Year thing. I don't think they're doing a judging of that until that big shootout happens and they pass the three people with the clipboards and everything. You know, I love that too. Oh my god, this is one of those movies where I sit there and I'm like, oh, what about this part? No, what about that part? The other part too is when he finally gets Jim Broadbent to, like, you know, to tell everybody this is a murder scene and everything, and they have to go off and do their jobs and everything. And Patty Considine and his partner, like, it's in the pouring rain and they have their sunglasses on. And they're sitting there like, I was really surprised that I was not at the pub by now. That's what I was surprised about.
I wonder, like, if it's one of those movies where it's a futile endeavor to try to pick your favorite part, right? Because there's just so many things. I will tell you the part I laughed hardest at this time, for whatever reason, was after the fight with the YARP guy, and he takes his walkie-talkie and he does two YARPs and then he has to answer no. And to watch him process, is it this easy? Is it really this easy? Narp.
What's funny to me is I don't even know if that's what he's saying, but I had a note about this moment too, so you're reading my mind. But It's almost like he has never heard this guy say anything but yarp. He doesn't even know if there is a no response.
Exactly.
And maybe the guy who asked the question on the other end, like, is expecting a different tone of yarp to mean no.
Right?
He doesn't know.
Yeah.
He doesn't know.
It honestly, I think he could have said either one, and it would have been fine, because the expectation of him on the other end of the line is that Nicholas Angel is dead. So it doesn't matter whether he says yarp or narp, or even if he says a full sentence in that tone, it feels like, oh, well, the job's done. I don't need to investigate this any further, because it's the fact that Nicholas Angel got past that situation is so beyond my comprehension at this point. So I thought about that too. It's a really funny moment.
There's lots of really subtle and funny. Jeremy, you mentioned how subtle some of this stuff is and how you can catch it or not. It's fine, but there's a lot of subtle running gags too. And one of my favorite is Olivia Colman's character saying, something completely inappropriate. And then the guy who we don't understand, everything he says, just will utter like, tits or balls or he's getting the cock. Like he's restating the joke or whatever. I just slayed me every time that happened. I thought that was hilarious.
The translating scene with the two guys who mumble, that's really funny to me too.
Yeah, the double translation is great. Yeah.
All right, well, I guess Jeremy and I need to come up with a super secret double feature.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I'd actually took a long time. Oh shit. I actually took a long time for mine as well. I wanted to kind of go outside the box, although it still has some of the elements of this and everything. I don't know how this movie matches tonally, but I think a good double feature would be Doc Hollywood, mainly just because you have someone coming from the big city who ends up in a small city. Of course, he is accidentally in a small city in that movie. His car breaks down, which, then later on, it inspires the movie Cars. It's the sort of the same sort of deal, right? It's someone who knows a lot about his profession, and he becomes the doctor of that town. And a lot of their small town ways don't make sense to him, and he's got to set them straight on a lot of things. But meanwhile, he's also learning things about small town ways that he really appreciates. And by the end of the movie, he really loves the small town by the end of it. So I don't think these movies match tonally, but there's not very many that do, I don't think, to have it's an action comedy that's this smart and well put together. I don't want to take Jeremy's if he's thinking about one.
But I got
saw
one in the chat. Six. You go ahead.
Okay. I saw one in the chat that was really good, which would be The Other Guys, which has a lot of that in there, because you have the main team with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg, but you have that other team that The Rock and Samuel L. Jackson are constantly, they're doing the Patty Considine stuff in this. That would be a good one, but I'm going to stick with Doc Hollywood on this.
I'm going to give you two. The one I want to give you is so out of the box. I feel like I have to give you a traditional one as well, so that the people don't riot. So my traditional one, I believe, will match in tone. I believe it is a comedy that takes its action incredibly seriously and has multiple styles of comedy, physical, wordplay, parody, and that would be Game Night. And I think that would be, Jeremy from a normal week of this show would pick Game Night. But this week, I kind of got stuck on how much Hot Fuzz is both aping and loving these movies and this style of film. Like, it's making fun, it's having fun with and parodying, but it clearly loves with its whole heart the stuff that it's making fun of. And I could not get the movie Trekkies out of my brain. That is a documentary about Star Trek fans, tonally would be complete miss for a double feature here. But in terms of a movie that makes fun of something it clearly loves and adores, that movie just wouldn't leave my brain after this viewing of Hot Fuzz, just for that reason. I'm going to underline Game Night, but just know that Trekkies is up there hovering around thinking it deserves some say. So,
yeah.
Good anyway, stuff. Yeah, that was way off book. Apologize. I'll try not to do that anymore.
No, please. I think those are the most interesting double features is when we could have easily come up with, you know, what the movie itself is basically saying it is, you know, The Wicker Man or, you know, any of these like Point Break and Bad Boys 2 and all this, you know, you could easily say those. I was trying to think of something that was kind of had some of the same thread, but not like, and I like the idea of Trekkies being a double feed. I guarantee you Edgar Wright probably would like that idea.
Well, the chat is saying Galaxy Quest, and that's a really good example of something that is absolutely making fun of the thing it loves while being the thing it loves.
So, yeah. Galaxy Quest, a really, really good idea on that one. That's a good suggestion.
Good call,
yeah.
Shaggy Nuts.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. He forces, or he or she, or they force us to say that, Shaggy Nuts every time we see this. Is awesome. So, nuts. Anyway, what is going to be the movie that we are going to watch next week, Jeremy?
There's been too much laughter around these parts for the last couple of weeks. Too much hilarity, and it's time to bring the hammer of emotion down. And maybe you are like me. Maybe you knew of Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler's films like Creed and Black Panther before you ever went back to their first collaboration, Fruitvale Station. And when you go back to this for the first time or the second time, it should probably break your heart. I'm not giddy about breaking your heart. I'm kind of pretending that I want to, you know, make everybody sad, but tonally we gotta break things up. Fruitvale Station.
This is a whiplash. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a short film, hour and 25 minutes. Really well acted. Octavia Spencer's in this. Michael B. Jordan is the main star, Chad Michael Murray. This, when I sent my prep email 2 days ago, the internet told me this was on Max. But right now, it's telling me it's on Roku channel for free, Amazon Prime, Peacock with a subscription. I don't know. Try and find it in places. If you don't find it in any of those places I just named, try Max, because Google may just be confused.
This is a very interesting. When I first watched this movie, like we took a trip to San Francisco the year this movie came out, Jeremy and I, and I stayed for a few extra days, and I had heard of this movie, but I didn't know what it was about. And I rode the BART station from San Francisco to Oakland.
Oh, wow.
And Fruitvale Station came out. And I was like, oh, so it's about this particular station.
Yeah.
And and then I watched the movie, I think, while I was there. So
Wild.
So
yeah, it was based on a true story and a real place. Yeah. And somebody asked in the chat where the Trekkies documentary could be found streaming, and for that one person I googled, and you can find it on Tubi or Plex or Amazon Prime for free. If you want to check
it's well out. Worth it. I remember it being good.
Yep, me too. I think I built that when it came to Hollywood 27. Looks like we've got time for some questions.
Yeah.
Any questions?
question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
What's your favorite movie with five or fewer characters?
Man, this was tough to come up with. I thought it would be easy because, you know, surely I've seen plenty of movies like this, but and then to find one that I actually like too. Going back to the Ryan Reynolds well here, he's in a movie called Buried.
Nice.
That I think is really, really good, and it's got a great ending to it as well. If you guys have never seen Buried, I would recommend that movie. But I was wondering, because I haven't seen it in a while. Remember, we all talked about Locke possibly being in this, but we thought that maybe Locke had more than five characters. And I think they do with all the voice acting that's going on in that movie. I don't know if there's more than five in this movie, but there's definitely, I think there's only a few, and I don't think it gets to five. So anyway, that would be mine. And I thought about Glengarry Glen Ross. Glen Ross definitely has more than five. Mm. So,
Yeah, I think this is like a measure of the law, spirit of the law kind of thing with a question like this, where it's like, you know, you're talking about like one-handers, two-handers, those kind of things. How do you define characters? Is it just somebody who like is cast and has a character name and they're in the movie, or is it somebody who's a prominent character? So I kind of went both ways. I think Gravity fits the bill under the spirit of the law, and Gravity is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah.
And really just features, you know, Clooney and Bullock and, you know, a couple people from the ground crew. But yeah, I mentioned Locke. 10 Cloverfield Lane kind of is that thing too, where there's voices and other people in it. Do they count as characters? So the one movie I know fits no matter what is Bo Burnham's Inside, which I just adore, and is just Bo Burnham. Everything in that movie is Bo Burnham. Written, directed, edited, produced, you know, all the music, all the acting, and is a testament to the mental anguish of the pandemic and being stuck inside, and at the same time, one of the most hilarious things I've ever seen as well. I don't know how he pulled it off, but he did. It's really impressive.
Who's because he's one of those generational talents, right?
I mean, if I didn't believe it before that movie, I believe it now.
I went with The Artifice Girl. I think you could technically hit me, because we've got the three main human leads and then Cherry, the digital character. And then there is that one scene where there's like two office workers who share three lines of dialogue about the building being sold. I'm choosing not to call those characters.
Exactly.
But I found that to be a difficult one to answer, because there's not as many. You think of something like, oh, Castaway. Oh, shit. There's a bunch of people in the beginning and end of that movie.
Over in chat, we've got Secret Window with Johnny Depp and John Turturro. I have never seen Secret Window because it was spoiled for me a long time ago, and I heard that the movie wasn't all that great, but maybe something I should visit at some point. We'll go ahead.
That's a great choice. Mass is a great choice because it's the four of them and then one person, I think, at the church that like welcomes them.
There's one, but there's a two. There's a second.
There's a second person at the church. Yeah.
You know, I think when you limit it to five or fewer, you're just kind of being wishy-washy. I think it.
That person will never submit another question to us.
No, I know. I'm not upset at the question. It's just we're sitting there trying to like, you know, come up with a movie. I think a lot of movies fit the vibe of what this question is asking. And then you get technicalities, throw it out of whack. So I think it depends on how you define it, I guess.
How many people are in the elevator in that Devil M. Night Shyamalan written movie?
It's like six or seven, I think.
That's what I thought. I thought it was more than five.
Another one that was mentioned was My Dinner with Andre, and that definitely is two characters and maybe the waiter. I don't know if the waiter's even a character really, but that would certainly.
Oh, Blair Witch. That's a good
Blair Witch is another good one, although they do interview some people at the beginning. I don't know if it counts to five. Anyway.
Yeah, and I thought of like Rope. Like for a second, because it's just really the three of them, but that party throws it all off because there's a party at the beginning when there's a bunch of people. So, yeah.
Right. All right. Room for one more?
I believe we have room for one more. Have you ever adopted a word or phrase from a movie or show and it has become a permanent part of your vocabulary?
So many from The Simpsons. I watching that show through the 90s and even beyond, and I finally quit like 10, 12 years ago because it was just too much to keep up with anymore. But there's so many things in there. I'll sometimes if I say, oh, no, I'll go, oh, no, beta. And then like there's like anytime somebody says I do or we do, I go right into that Stonecutter song, like who makes Steve Guttenberg a star, we do. And then like but yeah, it's like a million, like there's an episode where Matlock shows up, Andy Griffith shows up to the town, and Abe and his buddy are like, they are there, and they like storm the stage and like steal all the stuff from Matlock. And then they're the next thing they're, you see is they're on the bus, and you hear that one guy who's like, I don't understand, Abe. You got to meet Matlock and you took his pills. So anytime I say pills, I have to go down into that register and say, I need to go take my pills. So anyway, there you go.
Yeah, The Simpsons. I actually had one from The Simpsons as well that I wrote down, which is dope, which, mm-hmm. you know, is just like not a word, but somehow is now a word and used. In fact, I was reading something the other day that the word meh, M-E-H, actually started on The Simpsons, or at least was popularized by Lisa Simpson, like way back in the day. It's really interesting how that show has had like that cultural impact. But the phrase I think works the best for me is bucket list. It is a phrase that was not in existence before the movie. And the movie The Bucket List invented that phrase, and now it's just, it has that meaning. I think Slate technically found a use of it in a book like 2 years before the movie. They did some research and it had been used, but as far as like, you know, being in prominence in any way whatsoever, yeah, it was that movie.
In the spirit of the question, whenever anybody says The Bucket List, I have to do Stanley Tucci from Easy A. Remind me, after we're done watching The Bucket List, to check Watch The Bucket List off of my bucket
off
list.
Of my bucket list. There's so much, like, if this movie, like, I like this question because if it's not a movie quote question, right? Like, it's like an actual word usage question. Like, I thought of things like, in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, which I say all the time. But that's a movie quote. That's not necessarily like a word or phrase that a, you know, a movie or show kind of put in my life. So I really like this question. But yeah, I think bucket list is probably one.
I have several answers. I don't think any of them are good. But my wife and I have two short phrases that, like Chris, I have to slip into kind of an impression anytime we're casually apologizing. Like, I don't mean like we're having a fight and we're apologizing. I mean like, you know, I went to hand her something and I dropped it before it got to her. I'll be like, sorry. And then I'll immediately do that guy from Seinfeld whose cane steps on Elaine's toe in the bakery. And she goes, ah, and he goes, sorry. And then he walks away. So if I'm humorously apologizing to my wife, I will go, sorry. And then anytime one of us says it has to be, the other one will do Jim Carrey from Liar Liar going, it has to be, after he's asked, is that the truth? It has to be. So those are my answers to this question. So.
Yeah, over in the chat, we've got more Simpsons. You fail English? That's impossible. Yeah, that's another. That's a good Ralphism. Ralphisms work everywhere.
They do.
And then Shaggy Nuts once again started using due diligence after Dark Knight. And then 8 says Yabos, which I think is a Hocus Pocus reference. I'm not sure. That's the first time I had ever heard Yabos before. But anyway, maybe he's, maybe not. I don't know. What's going on? All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Next week will be Fruitville Station. I also think, even though I have not truly gotten an answer from my co-hosts over here, that we're doing the best of 2023 after this. So it'll be Fruitville Station, and then I think that's where we're going. I'm not sure. I don't
I'm good with that,
because it'll be something that comes out right after the Oscars, so I'm assuming that's where we're headed. But if not, then I'm a total liar and we'll do like 5 more episodes before we get to the best of 2023. Anyway, once again, thank you, chat, for coming out and watching us. We love you guys, and that's gonna do it for this episode. We'll see you next time. See you.
Bye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Yo, I just literally just read 10 minutes ago this Sam Mendes Beatles movie news. Did you guys see this?
No, tell me about it.
He's going to make 4 movies, each from the perspective of a different Beatle. and release them all in 2027. He's already got the permission and song use from all four members of the band.
Or this their estates.
Going to be the most amazing thing ever, or I'm really going to wish he'd used 3 years to do something different, because I love Sam Mendes films and I don't give a shit about the Beatles. So,
oh really? You're anti-Beatles?
Not anti-Beatles. Listen to my words. I don't give a shit about them. Which means
sounds anti to me, but
they're just another band to me. I think.
Okay.
I think they are the very definition of overrated, which does not mean they are not great.
What was the movie where Phil Hartman had the line, "I didn't like the Beatles and I don't like you"?
He's never really ever had a big role in a movie, but he always had something memorable. Mm-hmm. It feels like that, yeah. Like he has such a memorable moment in So I Married an Axe Murderer, being that Alcatraz guy.
Yes,
you know, and it's like, now this is something that you won't hear on the other tours, but this guy took what we call a bitch, and
they took turns pissing in the guy's ocular cavities.
Yes, I don't know what's going on, but like, there's been two or three news stories like this Beatles thing where everybody in the fucking world tells me about it as soon as they see the thing. So early this morning, it had somebody text me about the Beatles thing, and then Jeremy tells me about the Beatles thing, and then a completely different person has just texted me about the Beatles thing.
Yeah, it's that kind of news. It feels like one of those things where it's like there's something about it that's so audacious or something, mm-hmm. that everybody's like, oh my goodness.
We all know the Ringo movie's going to make the least amount of money.
Yeah, definitely.
I love this idea. By the way, I have come out very strongly against like part ones, part twos, and you know, that kind of thing. I think, you know, just make movies. But the exception is if they're released close together. I actually think it's like what Costner is doing, I don't have as much of a problem with. The fact that both parts are coming up out within like 3 months of each other, you know, kind of thing. That feels a little better to me. But like spreading it out for a year or more, it's just like,
and that movie's either gonna be amazing or it's gonna be the most self-loving, bloated bullshit ever, because it's his passion project, the mm-hmm. Costner thing.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, something Horizon. Like, he's been sitting on it for 20-30 years. I'm pretty sure he wrote it, he's starring in it, he's directing it, produced it. So it could be Dances with Wolves or it could be The Postman, and I'm hoping for the better. I like more of his movies that he's directed than I don't. But
I just watched Wyatt Earp for the first time in a while, and actually really enjoying it, and more than I thought I would. So I think he's in his zone with this stuff.
Don't make me have arguments I used to have 20 years ago
about Tombstone.
Wyatt Earp and Tombstone, can both be good. They're in the same universe.
Right, they're totally different movies.
They're not trying to be the same thing at all.
No,
I just, the thing that bothered me was that as great as Val Kilmer is in Tombstone, and he probably is the best thing about it, it ended up overshadowing Dennis Quaid's performance in Wyatt Earp,
right?
Which is just as amazing.
Yeah.
That may be why I'm such a Wyatt Earp stan, is because that performance, plus the OK Corral sequence in that movie, is pretty rad.
I think you're a Wyatt Earp stan because that movie's amazing. I just watched it. It's really, really good. That movie is weird, man. That's another one I just recently watched.
Young Guns?
Yeah, that I had never seen it, and
man, how does that play today to somebody who's never seen it?
Not well.
That's what I was thinking. That scene where they're in the house and all the bad guys, all the cops are outside, and he's like, "I see you got this one guy with you," and then he stands up and shoots him. Not with you anymore. I will never forget that scene.
I watched two commentaries on Hot Fuzz.
Oh, nice.
Because I have the disc and it's got like four or five mm-hmm. commentaries on it. One of them is Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg, which is the one I wanted to see first, to see the creators talk about it. And they don't go too much in the weeds about the movie. I mean, they'll talk about actors and movies that influenced them and stuff like that. Very interesting commentary overall. Then there's one with Edgar Wright and Quentin Tarantino. Can you imagine that one staying on the rails?
Wow.
Oh, my.
I was like sitting there listening to that one. I was like, okay, what kind of insight? And there is some insight, but it's more like listening to Edgar Wright and Quentin Tarantino do a podcast.
Right.
And they're just kind of talking about all these British action films and directors and actors that you've never heard of before.
Right.
And I'm like, I feel like such a simp when I listen to them talk about all this stuff and everything. But it was an interesting thing to hear Edgar Wright say that he was a movie projectionist back
in
1989, apparently. And apparently he was very not good at it or whatever or something. And three months later, he was gone. But he said that some of the movies that were playing during the time that he was doing the projectionist stuff was Beaches. It was like Friday the 13th Part 4 or something like that, and then like Police Academy 6 were playing. But he said something like there was a thing in Hot Fuzz where they're going into the house with all the guns and everything, and you hear that soundtrack, which I had always attributed to Lethal Weapon, and it is attributed to Lethal Weapon, but it's not in the movie. It's just music for the trailer.
Oh, wow.
And I had heard that much like Edgar Wright when Lethal Weapon 4 came out, I believe. I used to hear that trailer, that music all the time. So I was like, I know this is from like Lethal Weapon, or it's at least something that Lethal Weapon took from some other movie and put it in the trailers. But I didn't realize they did that on all their trailers. They had that whatever. I thought that was funny that, like, if you were ever a movie projectionist, you know, especially back in the 35 millimeter days, you saw trailers hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, and you just knew them, and you just knew everything about them. And it's funny that he got inspired by a Lethal Weapon 2 trailer back in the day.
And it's amazing.
Put that music in his movie.
Yeah, there's a level of film fandom or encyclopedic knowledge that I don't know how to comprehend it. And when I listen to both of those guys, when I listen to either of those guys talk, I'm just like, all you do is must be sit down and watch movies. Like, I watch a lot of movies. Like, I watch, you know, 150 movies a year at least, right? I feel like that's a lot of movies. They must be watching 500 movies a year at least. Like, yeah. It's insane.
I think they are. I mean, I think that Not every director, but I think those guys in particular are just fucking film fiends, and they'll throw up five movies a day.
I'm jealous. I'm a little jealous. Like, I love movies, man. But there's just like, I listen to them talk, I can't imagine them having a conversation together. Well, like Edgar Wright has his 1001 movies, you know, greatest movies or whatever. He keeps it updated on Letterboxd and, you know, whatever. And I've seen, I think last time I checked, 31% of that 1001 movies. And I'm just like, that's like 700 movies I have to watch that are best movies ever made.
Like, I saw him do there's a video on YouTube with him talking about top 10. I don't know if it was a genre or if it was an all-timer or what, but he went through these 10 movies. And I think this was when he was doing, what was the last movie he came out with?
Last Night in Soho?
Last Night in Soho, that's right. He was naming like 10 horror movies or something like that. And I was like, nope, haven't seen any of these.
But let's remember this. Christopher Nolan gave an interview recently where he said he unapologetically loves the Fast and Furious movies.
Yeah.
So let's take all directors' lists with a grain of salt, right?